Chapter 43. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 17, 1980. This meeting was held at the home of Larry Underwood on South 42nd Street in the Table Mesa area. All members of the committee were present. The first item of business concerned having the ad hoc committee elected as the permanent Boulder committee. Fran Goldsmith was recognized. Fran. Both Stu and I agree that the best, easiest way for us all to get elected would be if Mother Abigail endorsed the whole slate. It would save us the problem of having 20 people nominated by their friends and possibly upsetting the apple cart. But now we'll have to do it in another way. I'm not going to suggest anything that isn't perfectly democratic, and you all know the plan anyway, but I just wanted to reemphasize that each of us has to make sure we have someone who will nominate and second us. We can't do it for each other, obviously. That would look too much like the mafia. And if you can't find one person to nominate you and another to second you, you might as well give up anyway. Glenn Bateman said that he had intended to address the committee on the subject of our scouts or spies or whatever you want to call them, but that he wanted to make a motion instead that we meet to discuss that on the 19th. Stu asked him why, and Glenn said, "Because we might not all be here on the 19th. That was good for a moment of silence, and then the committee voted 7-0 to meet on the 19th as a permanent committee to discuss the question of scouts or spies or whatever. Stu was recognized to put a third item of business before the committee concerning Mother Abigail. Stu. As you know, she's gone off for reasons of her own. Her note says she'll be gone for a while, which is pretty vague, and that she'll be back if it's God's will. Now, that's not very encouraging. We've had a search party out for 3 days now, and we haven't found a thing. We don't want to just drag her back, not if she doesn't want to go, but if she's lying up there somewhere with a busted leg or if she's unconscious, that's a lot different. Now, part of the problem is that there just aren't enough of us to search all the wild lands around here. But another part of it is the same thing that's slowing us down at the power station. There's just no organization. So what I'm looking for is permission to put this search party on the agenda of the big meeting tomorrow night, same as the power station and the burial crew. And I'd like to see Harold Lauder in charge, because it was his idea in the first place. Glenn said that he didn't think any search party was going to find very good news after a week or so. After all, the lady in question is 108 years old. The committee as a whole agreed with that, and then voted in favor of the motion, 7-0, as Stu had put it. To make this record as honest as possible, I should add that there were several expressions of doubt over putting Harold in charge. But as Stu pointed out, it had been his idea to begin with, and to not give him command of the search party would be a direct slap in the face. Nick. I withdraw my objection to Harold, but not my basic reservations. I just don't like him very much. Ralph Brentner asked if either Stu or Glenn would write out Stu's motion about the search party so he could add it to the agenda, which he plans to print at the high school tonight. Stu said he'd be glad to. Larry Underwood then moved that we adjourn. Ralph seconded it, and it was voted 7-0. Francis Goldsmith, secretary. The turnout for the meeting the next evening was almost total, and for the first time, Larry Underwood, who had only been in the zone a week, got an idea of just how large the community was becoming. It was one thing to see people coming and going on the streets, usually alone or by twos, and quite another to see them all gathered together in one place, the Chautauqua Auditorium. The place was full, every seat taken, and more people sitting in the aisles and standing at the back of the hall. They were a curiously subdued crowd, murmuring but not babbling. For the first time since he had gotten to Boulder, it had rained all day long, a soft drizzle that seemed to hang suspended in the air, fogging you rather than wetting you. And even with the assemblage of close to 600, you could hear the quiet sound of rain on the roof. The loudest sound inside was the constant riffle of paper as people looked at the mimeographed agendas that had been piled up on two card tables just inside the double doors. Larry found that his nervous hands had been busy folding his agenda, which he knew nearly word for word, into a paper airplane. Being on the ad hoc committee was sort of fun, like a game. Children playing at the parliamentary process in someone's living room, sitting around and drinking Cokes, having a piece of the cake Franny had made, talking things over. Even the part about sending spies over the mountains and right into the dark man's lap had seemed like a game. partly because it was a thing he couldn't imagine doing himself. You'd have to have lost most of your marbles to face such a living nightmare. But in their closed sessions, with the room comfortably lit with Coleman gas lanterns, it had seemed okay. And if the judge or Dana Jurgens or Tom Cullen got caught, it seemed, in those closed sessions at least, a thing no more important than losing a rook or a queen in a chess game. But now, sitting halfway down the hall with Lucy on one side and Leo on the other, he had not seen Nadine all day, and Leo didn't seem to know where she was either. Out had been his disinterested response. The truth of it came home, and in his guts it felt as if a battering ram was in use. It was no game. There were 580 people here, and most of them didn't have any idea that Larry Underwood wasn't no nice guy, or that the first person Larry Underwood had attempted to take care of after the epidemic had died of a drug overdose. His hands were damp and chilly. They were trying to fold the agenda into a paper plane again, and he stopped them. Lucy took one of them, squeezed it, and smiled at him. He was only able to respond with something that felt like a grimace, and in his heart he heard his mother's voice. "There's something left out of you, Larry." He began to feel panicky. Was there a way out of this, or had things already gone too far? He didn't want this millstone. He had already made a motion in closed session that could send Judge Ferris to his death. If he was voted out and someone else was voted into his seat, they'd have to take another vote on sending the judge, wouldn't they? Sure they would. And they'd vote to send someone else. "When Laurie Constable nominates me, I'll just stand up and say I decline." Sure, nobody can force me, can they? Not if I decide I want out. And who the fuck needs this kind of hassle? Wayne Stuckey on that long-ago beach saying, "There's something in you that's like biting on tinfoil." Quietly, Lucy said, "You'll be fine." He jumped, "Huh?" "I said you'll be fine, won't he, Leo?" "Oh, yes," Leo said, bobbing his head. His eyes never left the audience, as if he was not able to comprehend its size. "Fine." "You don't understand, you numb fucking broad," Larry thought. "You're holding my hand and you don't understand that I could make a bad decision and wind up killing both of you. I'm well on my way to killing Judge Ferris and he's seconding my fucking nomination." What a Polish fire drill this turned out to be. A little sound escaped from his throat. "Did you say something?" Lucy asked. "No." Then Stu was walking across the stage to the podium, his red sweater and blue jeans very bright and clear in the harsh glow of the emergency lights, which were running from a Honda generator that Brad Kitchener and part of his crew from the power station had set up. The applause started somewhere in the middle of the hall, Larry was never sure where, and a cynical part of him was always convinced that it had been a plant arranged by Glenn Bateman, their resident expert in the art-craft of crowd management. At any rate, it didn't really matter. The first solitary spats swelled to a thunder of applause. On the stage, Stu paused by the podium, looking comically amazed. The applause was joined by cheers and shrill whistles. Then the entire audience rose to its feet, the applause swelling to a sound like heavy rain, and people were shouting, "Bravo! Bravo!" Stu held up his hands, but they wouldn't stop. If anything, the sound redoubled in intensity. Larry glanced sideways at Lucy and saw she was applauding strenuously, her eyes fixed on Stu, her mouth curved in a trembling but triumphant smile. She was crying. On his other side, Leo was also applauding, bringing his hands together again and again with so much force that Larry thought they would fall off if Leo kept on much longer. In the extremity of his joy, Leo's carefully won-back vocabulary had deserted him, the way English will sometimes desert a man or woman who has learned it as his or her second tongue. He could only hoot loudly and enthusiastically. Brad and Ralph had also run a PA from the generator, and now Stu blew into the mic and then spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen..." But the applause rolled on. "Ladies and gentlemen, if you'll take your seats..." But they were not ready to take their seats. The applause roared on, and Larry looked down because his own hands hurt, and he saw that he was applauding as frantically as the rest. "Ladies and gentlemen..." The applause thundered and echoed. Overhead, a family of barn swallows that had taken up residence in this fine and private place after the plague struck now flew about crazily, swooping and diving, mad to get away to someplace where people weren't. We're applauding ourselves, Larry thought. We're applauding the fact that we're here, alive, together. Maybe we're saying hello to the group self again, I don't know. Hello, Boulder. Finally. Good to be here, great to be alive. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd take your seats, please. The applause began to taper off little by little. Now you could hear ladies, and some men, too, sniffling. Noses were honked. Conversations were whispered. There was that rustling auditorium sound of people taking their seats. I'm glad you're all here, Stu said. I'm glad to be here myself. There was a whine of feedback from the PA, and Stu muttered, "Goddamn thing," which was clearly picked up and broadcast. There was a ripple of laughter, and Stu colored. Guess we're all going to have to get used to this stuff again, he said, and that set off another burst of applause. When that had run itself out, Stu said, "For those of you who don't know me, I'm Stuart Redman, originally from Arnett, Texas, although that seems a far way down the road from where I am now, let me tell you." He cleared his throat, feedback whined briefly, and he took a wary step back from the mic. "I'm also pretty nervous up here, so bear with me." "We will, Stu," Harry Dunbarton yelled exuberantly, and there was appreciative laughter. It's like a camp meeting, Larry thought. Next they'll be singing hymns. If Mother Abigail was here, I bet we would be already. Last time I had so many people looking at me was when our little consolidated high school made it to the football playoffs. And then they had 21 other guys to look at, too, not to mention some girls in those little tiny skirts. A hearty burst of laughter. Lucy whispered in Larry's ear, "What was he worried about? He's a natural." Larry nodded. "But if you'll bear with me, I'll get through it somehow," Stu said. More applause. This crowd would applaud Nixon's resignation speech and ask him to encore on the piano, Larry thought. "First off, I should explain about the ad hoc committee and how I happen to be up here at all," Stu said. "There are seven of us who got together and planned for this meeting so we could get organized somehow. There's a lot of things to do, and I'd like to introduce each member of our committee to you now. And I hope you saved some applause for them, because they all pitched together to work out the agenda you've got in your hands right now. First, Miss Frances Goldsmith. Stand up, Franny. Let them see what you look like with a dress on." Fran stood up. She was wearing a pretty Kelly green dress and a modest string of pearls that might have cost $2,000 in the old days. She was roundly applauded, the applause accompanied by some good-natured wolf whistles. Fran sat down, blushing furiously, and before the applause could die away entirely, Stu went on, "Mr. Glenn Bateman from Woodsville, New Hampshire." Glenn stood, and they applauded him. He waved to the crowd, and they roared their approval. Stu introduced Larry second to last, and he stood up, aware that Lucy was smiling up at him, and then that was lost in the warm comber of applause that washed over him. Once, he thought, in another world, there would have been concerts, and this kind of applause would have been reserved for the show closer, a little-nothing tune called Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? This was better. He only stood for a second, but it seemed much longer. He knew he would not decline his nomination. Stu introduced Nick last, and he got the longest, loudest applause. When it died away, Stu said, "This wasn't on the agenda, but I wonder if we could start by singing the national anthem. I guess you folks remember the words." There was that ruffling, shuffling sound of people getting to their feet. Another pause as everyone waited for someone else to start. Then a girl's sweet voice rose in the air, solo for only the first three syllables. "Oh, say can." It was Franny's voice, but for a moment it seemed to Larry to be underlaid by another voice, his own. And the place was not Boulder, but upstate Vermont, and the day was July 4th. The Republic was 204 years old, and Rita lay dead in the tent behind him, her mouth filled with green puke and a bottle of pills in her stiffening hand. A chill of goose flesh passed over him, and suddenly he felt that they were being watched. Watched by something that could, in the words of that old song by The Who, see for miles and miles and miles. For just a moment, he felt an urge to run from this place. Just run and never stop. This was no game they were playing here. This was serious business. Killing business. Maybe worse. Then other voices joined in. Can you see by the dawn's early light? And Lucy was singing, holding his hand, crying again. And others were crying. Most of them were crying. Crying for what was lost and bitter. The runaway American dream, chrome-wheeled, fuel-injected, and stepping out over the line. And suddenly his memory was not of Rita, dead in the tent, but of he and his mother at Yankee Stadium. It was September 29th. The Yankees were only a game and a half out of first place, and all things were still possible. There were 55,000 people in the stadium, all standing, the players in the field with their caps over their hearts. Catfish on the mound, Thurman Munson behind the plate in his gear. By the twilight's last gleaming. And the light standards were on in the purple gloaming, moths and night flyers banging softly against them. And New York was around them, teeming, city of night and light. Larry joined the singing too, and when it was done, and the applause rolled out once more, he was crying a bit himself. Rita was gone. Alice Underwood was gone. New York was gone. America was gone. Even if they could defeat the dark man, whatever they might make would never be the same. Sweating freely under the bright emergency lights, Stu called the first items, reading and ratification of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The singing of the anthem had also affected him deeply, and he wasn't alone. Half the audience, more, was in tears. No one asked for an actual reading of either document, which would have been their right under the parliamentary process, for which Stu was profoundly grateful. He wasn't much of a reader. The reading section of each item was approved by the Free Zone citizens. Glenn Bateman rose and moved that they accept both documents as governing Free Zone law. A voice in the back said, "Second that." "Moved and seconded," Stu said. "Those in favor say aye." "Aye to the rooftops." Kojak, who'd been sleeping by Glenn's chair, looked up, blinked, and then laid his muzzle on his paws again. A moment later, he looked up again as the crowd gave themselves a thunderous round of applause. That preliminary taken care of, Stu felt tension worm into his muscles. Now, he thought, we'll see if there are any nasty surprises waiting for us. "The third item on your agenda reads," he began, and then he had to clear his throat again. Feedback whined at him, making him sweat even more. Fran was looking calmly up at him, nodding for him to go on. "It reads, to see if the Free Zone will nominate and elect a slate of 7 Free Zone representatives. That means, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?" Stu looked up from his jotted notes and felt a real jolt of fear, accompanied by something like a premonition. It was Harold Lauder. Harold was dressed in a suit and a tie, his hair was neatly combed, and he was standing halfway up the middle aisle. Once Glenn had said he thought the opposition might coalesce around Harold. But so soon? He hoped not. For just a moment he thought wildly of not recognizing Harold, but both Nick and Glenn had warned him of the dangers inherent in making any part of this look like a railroad job. He wondered if he had been wrong about Harold turning over a new leaf. It looked as if he was going to find out right here. "Chair recognizes Harold Lauder." Heads turned, necks craned to see Harold better. "I'd like to move that we accept the slate of ad hoc committee members in toto as the permanent committee, if they'll serve, that is." Harold sat down. There was a moment of silence. Stu thought crazily, "Toto? Toto? Wasn't that the dog in The Wizard of Oz?" Then the applause swelled out again, filling the room, and dozens of cries of "I second" ran out. Harold was sitting placidly in his seat again, smiling and talking to the people who were thumping him on the back. Stu brought his gavel down 6 times for order. "He planned this," Stu thought. "These people are going to elect us, but it's Harold they'll remember." Still, he got to the root of the thing in a way none of us thought of, not even Glenn. It was pretty damn near a stroke of genius. So why should he be so upset? Was he jealous, maybe? "There's a motion on the floor," he blared into the mic, ignoring the feedback whine this time. Motion on the floor, folks. He pounded the gavel and they quieted to a low babble. It's been moved and seconded that we accept the ad hoc committee just as it stands as the permanent free zone committee. Before we go to a discussion of the motion or a vote, I ought to ask if anyone now serving on the committee has an objection or would like to step down. Silence from the floor. Very well, Stu said. Discussion of the motion? I don't think we need any, Stu, Dick Ellis said. It's a grand idea. Let's vote. Applause greeted this, and Stu needed no further urging. Charlie Impening was waving his hand to be recognized, but Stu ignored him. A good case of selective perception, Glenn Bateman would have said, and called the question. Those in favor of Harold Lauder's motion, please signify by saying aye. Aye, they bellowed, sending the barn swallows into another frenzy. Opposed? But no one was, not even Charlie Impening, at least vocally. There was not a nay in the chamber. So Stu pushed on to the next item of business, feeling slightly dazed, as if someone, namely Harold Lauder, had crept up behind him and clopped him one on the head with a large sledgehammer made out of silly putty. Let's get off and push them a while, want to? Fran asked. She sounded tired. Sure. He got off his bike and walked along beside her. You okay, Fran? The baby bothering? No, I'm just tired. It's 1:15 in the morning, or hadn't you noticed? Yeah, it's late, Stu agreed, and they pushed their bikes side by side in companionable silence. The meeting had gone on until an hour ago, most of the discussion centering on the search party for Mother Abigail. The other items had all passed with a minimum of discussion, although Judge Ferris had provided a fascinating piece of information that explained why there were so relatively few bodies in Boulder. According to the last 4 issues of The Camera, Boulder's daily newspaper, a wild rumor had swept the community, a rumor that the superflu had originated in the Boulder air testing facility on Broadway. Spokesmen for the center, the few that were still on their feet, protested that it was utter nonsense, and anyone who doubted it was free to tour the facility, where they would find nothing more dangerous than air pollution indicators and wind vectoring devices. In spite of this, the rumor persisted, probably fed by the hysterical temper of those terrible days in late June. The air testing center had been either bombed or burned, and much of Boulder's population had fled. Both the burial committee and the power committee had been passed with an amendment from Harold Lauder, who had seemed almost awesomely prepared for the meeting, to the effect that each committee be increased by 2 for each increase of 100 in the total free zone population. The discussion of Mother Abigail's disappearance had covered far-reaching and sometimes comical ground. One man stated ominously that he had seen lights in the sky the night before Mother Abigail's disappearance, and that the prophet Isaiah had confirmed the existence of flying saucers. So they'd better put that in their collective pipe and smoke it, hadn't they? Judge Ferris rose in turn to point out that the previous gentleman had mistaken Isaiah for Ezekiel, that the exact reference was not to flying saucers but to a wheel within a wheel, and that the judge himself was of the opinion that the only flying saucers yet proven were those that sometimes flew during marital spats. Person after person rose to protest the charge that Mother Abigail had laid upon herself, that of pride. They spoke of her courtesy and her ability to put a person at ease with just a word or a sentence. Ralph Brentner, who looked awed by the size of the crowd and was nearly tongue-tied, but determined to speak his piece, rose and spoke in that vein for nearly 5 minutes, adding at the end that he had not known a finer woman since his mother had died. When he sat down, he seemed very near tears. When taken together, the discussion reminded Stu uncomfortably of what you hear about the dead when there's a viewing at the mortuary the night before the dear departed is lowered into the ground. It told him that in their hearts they had already come halfway to giving her up. If she did return now, Abby Freemantle would find herself welcomed, still sought after, still listened to. But she would also find, Stu thought, that her position was subtly changed. If a showdown between her and the Free Zone Committee came, it was no longer a foregone conclusion that she would win, veto power or not. She had gone away, and the community had continued to exist. The community would not forget that, as they had already half forgotten the power of the dreams that had brought them together. After the meeting, more than 24 people had sat for a while on the lawn behind Chautauqua Hall. The rain had stopped, the clouds were tattering, and the evening was pleasantly cool. Stu and Franny had sat with Larry, Lucy, Leo, and Harold. "You darn near knocked us out of the ballpark this evening," Larry told Harold. He nudged Franny with an elbow. "I told you he was ace high, didn't I?" Harold had merely smiled and shrugged. "A couple of ideas, that's all. You seven have started things moving again. You should at least have the privilege of seeing it through to the end of the beginning." Now, 15 minutes after the two of them had left that impromptu gathering, Stu repeated, "You sure you're feeling okay?" "Yes, my legs are a little tired, that's all." "You want to take it easy?" She smiled wanly and nodded. "Something giving you the blues, honey?" She shook her head no, but he thought he saw tears in her eyes. "What is it? Tell me." "It's over, and I finally realized it, that's all. Less than 600 people singing the Star-Spangled Banner. It just kind of hit me all at once. The Ferris wheel isn't going around and around at Coney Island tonight. No one's having a nightcap at the Space Needle in Seattle. Know what I mean?" "Yeah, I do." In my diary, I had a little section called Things to Remember, so the baby would know, oh, all the things he never will. And it gives me the blues thinking of that. I should have called it Things That Are Gone. She did sob a little, stopping her bike so she could put the back of her hand to her mouth and try to keep it in. "It got everybody the same way," Stu said, putting an arm around her. "A lot of people are going to cry themselves to sleep tonight."
"I don't see how you can grieve for a whole country," she said, crying harder. "But I guess you can. These little things keep shooting through my mind. Car salesman, Frank Sinatra, old Orchard Beach in July, all crowded with people, most of them from Quebec. The Times. Oh, God, I sound like a friggin' Rod McEwen poem."
He held her, patting her back, remembering one time when his Aunt Betty had gotten a crying fit over some bread that didn't rise. She was big with his little cousin Laddie then, 7 months or so. And Stu could remember her wiping her eyes with the corner of a dish towel and telling him to never mind. Any pregnant woman was just 2 doors down from the mental ward because the juices their glands put out were always scrambled up into a stew. After a while, Franny said, "Okay, okay, better. Let's go." "Franny, I love you," he said.
"Yes," she said, "I know. And that makes it better most of the time."
"Harold sure was something tonight, wasn't he?"
"Yes, he was."
He smiled at her worried tone. "Bothered you a little, didn't it?"
"Yes, but I won't say so. You're in Harold's corner now."
"Nah, that's not fair, Fran. It bothered me, too. There we had those 2 advance meetings, hashed everything over to a fairly well, at least we thought so, and along comes Harold. He takes a whack here and a whack there and says, 'Ain't that what you really meant?' And we say, 'Yeah, thanks, Harold, it was.'" Stu shook his head. "Putting everybody up for blanket election. How come we never thought of that, Fran? That was sharp. And we never even discussed it."
"Well, none of us knew for sure what kind of mood they'd be in. I thought, especially after Mother Abigail walked off, that they'd be glum, maybe even mean, with that impening talking around like some kind of death crow.
I wonder if he should be shut up somehow," Stu said thoughtfully.
"But it wasn't like that. They were so exuberant just to be together. Did you feel that?"
"Yeah, I did.
It was like a tent revival almost. I don't think it was anything Harold had planned. He just seized the moment."
"I just don't know how to feel about him," Stu said. "That night after we hunted for Mother Abigail, I felt real bad for him. When Ralph and Glenn turned up, he looked downright horrible, like he was going to faint or something. But when we were talking out on the lawn just now and everybody was congratulating him, he seemed puffed up like a toad. Like he was smiling on the outside, and on the inside he was saying, 'There, you see what your committee's worth, you stupid bunch of fools?' He..."
Fran stopped her bike and looked down. "Speaking of Harold, do you see anything funny about my feet, Stuart?"
Stu looked at them judiciously. "Nope. Just that you're wearing those funny-looking earth shoes from up the street. And they're almighty big, of course."
She slapped at him. Earth shoes are very good for your feet. All the best magazines said so. And I happen to be a size 7 for your information. That's practically petite. So, what have your feet got to do with anything? It's late, honey. He began to push his bike again, and she fell in beside him. Nothing, I guess. It's just that Harold kept looking at my feet after the meeting when we were sitting out on the grass and talking things over. She shook her head, frowning a little. Now, why would Harold Lauder be interested in my feet? She asked. When Larry and Lucy got home, they were by themselves, walking hand in hand. Leo had gone into the house where he stayed with Nadine Mom sometime before. Now, as they walked toward the door, Lucy said, "It was quite a meeting. I never thought..." Her words caught in her throat as a dark form unfolded itself from the shadows of their porch. Larry felt hot fur leap up in his throat. "It's him," he thought wildly. "He's come to get me. I'm going to see his face." But then he wondered how he could have thought that, because it was Nadine Cross, that was all. She was wearing a dress of some soft bluish-gray material, and her hair was loose, flowing over her shoulders and down her back, dark hair shot with skeins of purest white. "She sort of makes Lucy look like a used car on a scalper's lot," he thought, before he could help himself, and then hated himself for thinking it. That was the old Larry talking. Old Larry. You might as well say old Adam. "Nadine," Lucy was saying shakily, with one hand pressed to her chest, "you gave me the fright of my life. I thought, well, I don't know what I thought." She took no notice of Lucy. "Can I talk to you?" she asked Larry. "What now?" He looked sideways at Lucy, or thought he did. Later, he was never able to remember what Lucy had looked like in that moment. It was as if she had been eclipsed, but by a dark star rather than by a bright one. "Now, it has to be now. In the morning, would... It has to be now, Larry, or never." He looked at Lucy again, and this time he did see her, saw the resignation on her face as she looked from Larry to Nadine and back again. He saw the hurt. "I'll be right in, Lucy." "No, you won't," she said dully. Tears had begun to sparkle in her eyes. "Oh, no, I doubt it." 10 minutes. 10 minutes, 10 years, Lucy said. "She's come to get you. Did you bring your dog collar and your muzzle, Nadine?" For Nadine, Lucy Swan did not exist. Her eyes were fixed only on Larry, those dark, wide eyes. For Larry, they would always be the strangest, most beautiful eyes he had ever seen. The eyes that come back to you, calm and deep, when you're hurt or in bad trouble or maybe just about out of your mind with grief. "I'll be in, Lucy," he said automatically. "She, go on." "Yes, I guess I will. She's come. I'm dismissed." She ran up the steps, stumbling on the top one, regaining her balance, pulling the door open, closing it behind her with a slam, cutting off the sound of her sobs even as they started. Nadine and Larry looked at each other for a long time, as if entranced. "This is how it happens," he thought, "when you catch someone's eyes across a room and never forget them, or see someone at the far end of a crowded subway platform that could have been your double, or hear a laugh on the street that could have been the laugh of the first girl you ever made love to." But something in his mouth tasted so bitter. "Let's walk down to the corner and back," Nadine said in a low voice. "Would you do that much?" "I'd better go into her. You picked one hell of a bad time to come here."
"Please, just down to the corner and back. If you want, I'll get down on my knees and beg, if that's what you want. Here, see?"
And to his horror, she did get down on her knees, pulling her skirt up a little so she could do it, showing him that her legs were bare of stockings, making him curiously certain that everything else was bare as well. Why should he think that? He didn't know. Her eyes were on him, making his head spin, and there was a sickening feeling of power involved here someplace, involved with having her on her knees before him, her mouth on a level with... "Get up," he said roughly. He took her hands and yanked her to her feet, trying not to see the way the skirt rode up even more before falling back into place. Her thighs were the color of cream. "Come on," he said, almost totally unnerved. They walked west, in the direction of the mountains, which were a negative presence far ahead, triangular patches of darkness blotting out the stars that had come out after the rain. Walking toward those mountains at night always made him feel queerly uneasy, but somehow adventurous. And now, with Nadine by his side, her hand resting lightly in the crook of his elbow, those feelings seemed heightened. A soft breeze meandered down the street, blowing papers before it. They passed King Supers, a few shopping carts standing in the big parking lot like dead sentinels, making him think of the Lincoln Tunnel. "It's hard," Nadine said, her voice still low. "She made it hard because she's right. I want you now, and I'm afraid I'm too late. I want to stay here." "Nadine, no," she said fiercely. "Let me finish. I want to stay here, can't you understand that? And if we're with each other, I'll be able to. You're my last chance," she said, her voice breaking. "Joe's gone now." "No, he hasn't," Larry said, feeling slow and stupid and bewildered. "We dropped him off at your place on the way home, isn't he there?" "No. There's a boy named Leo Rockway asleep in his bed." "What are you..." "Listen," she said. "Listen to me. Can't you listen? As long as I had Joe, I was all right. I could be as strong as I had to be. But he doesn't need me anymore, and I need to be needed." "He does need you." "Of course he does," Nadine said, and Larry felt afraid again. She wasn't talking about Leo anymore. He didn't know who she was talking about. "He needs me. That's what I'm afraid of. That's why I came to you." She stepped in front of him and looked up, her chin tilted. He could smell her secret, clean scent, and he wanted her. But part of him turned back toward Lucy. That was the part of him he needed if he was going to make it here in Boulder. If he let it go and went with Nadine, they might as well slink out of Boulder tonight. It would be finished with him. The old Larry triumphant. "I have to go home," he said. "I'm sorry. You'll have to work it out on your own, Nadine." "Work it out on your own." Weren't they the words he had been using to people in one form or another all his life? Why did they have to rise up this way when he knew he was right and still catch him and twist in him and make him doubt himself? "Make love to me," she said, and put her arms around his neck. She pressed her body against his, and he knew by its looseness, its warmth and springiness, that he had been right. She was wearing the dress, and that was all. Bucky tail naked underneath, he thought, and thinking it excited him blackly. "That's all right, I can feel you," she said, and began to wriggle against him, sideways, up and down, creating a delicious friction. "Make love to me, and that will be the end of it. I'll be safe. Safe. I'll be safe." He reached up, and later he never knew how he was able to do that, when he could have been inside her warmth in only three quick movements and one thrust, the way she wanted it. But somehow he reached up and unlocked her hands and pushed her away with such force that she stumbled and almost fell. A low moan came from her.
"Larry, if you knew..."
"Well, I don't. Why don't you try telling me instead of raping me?"
"Rape?"
she repeated, and laughed shrilly.
"Oh, that's funny. Oh, what you said. Me, rape you. Oh, Larry.
Whatever you want from me, you could have had. You could have had it last week or the week before. The week before that, I asked you to take it. I wanted you to have it."
"That was too soon," she whispered.
"And now it's too late," he said, hating the brutal sound of his voice, but unable to control it. He was still shaking all over from wanting her. How was he supposed to sound? "What are you going to do, huh?"
"All right. Goodbye, Larry."
She was turning away. In that instant, she was more than Nadine, turning her back on him forever. She was the oral hygienist. She was Yvonne, with whom he had shared an apartment in L.A. She had pissed him off, and so he had just slipped into his boogie shoes, leaving her holding the lease. She was Rita Blakemore. Worst of all, she was his mother. "Nadine?" She didn't turn around. She was a black shape, distinguishable from other black shapes, only when she crossed the street. Then she disappeared altogether against the black background of the mountains. He called her name once again, and she didn't answer. There was something terrifying in the way she had left him, the way she had just melted into that black backdrop. He stood in front of King Supers, hands clenched, brow covered with pearls of sweat in spite of the evening cool. His ghosts were with him now, and at last he knew how you pay off for not being no nice guy. Never clear about your own motivations, never able to weigh hurt against help except by rule of thumb, never able to get rid of the sour taste of doubt in your mouth, and... His head jerked up. His eyes widened until they seemed to bulge from his face. The wind had picked up again. It made a strange hooting sound in some empty doorway, and further away he thought he could hear boot heels pacing off the night. Run down boot heels, somewhere in the foothills, coming to him on the chilly draft of this early morning breeze. Lucy heard him let himself in, and her heart leaped up fiercely. She told it to stop, that he was probably only coming back for his things, but it would not stop. "He picked me," was the thought that hammered into her brain, driven there by her heart's trip-hammer beat. "He picked me." In spite of her excitement and hope, she lay stiffly on her back in the bed, waiting and watching nothing but the ceiling. The door clicked open, and she saw him in it, just a silhouette. "Lucy, you awake?" "Yes." "Can I put on the lamp?" "If you want." She heard the minute hiss of gas, and then the light came on, turned down to a thread of flame, revealing him. He looked pale and shaken. "I have to say something." "No, you don't. Just come to bed." "I have to say it. He pressed his hand against his forehead and ran it through his hair. "Larry?" She sat up. "Are you all right?" He spoke as if he hadn't heard her, and he spoke without looking at her. "I love you. If you want me, you got me. But I don't know if you're getting much. I'm never going to be your best bet, Lucy." "I'll take the chance. Come to bed." He did. And when the love was over, she told him she loved him. It was true, God knew that. But she didn't think that he slept for a long time. Once in the night she came awake, or dreamed she did, and it seemed to her that Larry was at the window, looking out, his head cocked in a listening posture, the lines of light and shadow giving his face the appearance of a haggard mask. But in the light of day she was more sure that it must have been a dream. In the light of day he seemed to be his old self again. It was only 3 days later that they heard from Ralph Brentner that Nadine had moved in with Harold Lauder. At that, his face seemed to tighten, but it was only for a moment. And although she disliked herself for it, Ralph's news made her breathe a little easier. It seemed it must be over. She went home only briefly after seeing Larry. She let herself in, went to the living room, and lit the lamp. Carrying it high, she went to the back of the house, pausing for just a moment to let the light spill into the boys' room. Leo lay all sprawling in a tangle of bedclothes, dressed only in his undershorts. But the cuts and scratches had faded, disappeared altogether in most cases, and the all-over tan he had gotten from going practically naked had also faded. He was not Joe anymore. This was just a boy sleeping after a busy day. She thought of the night she had been almost asleep and had come awake to find him gone from her side. That had been in North Berwick, Maine, most of the continent away now. She had followed him and had made him come back. He had been Joe then, and full of mute savagery. Hate pounced on Nadine in a surging flash, striking up brilliant sparks as if from flint and steel. The Coleman lamp trembled in her hand, making wild shadows leap and dance. She should have let him do it. She should have held the door for Joe herself, let him in so he could stab and rip and cut and puncture and gut and destroy. She should have... But now the boy turned over and moaned in his throat, as if waking. His hands came up and batted the air as if warding off a black shape in a dream. And Nadine withdrew, a pulse beating thickly at her temples. There was still something strange in the boy, and she didn't like the way he had moved just now, as if he had picked up her thoughts. She had to go ahead now. She had to be quick. She went into her own room, which was small and totally devoid of character. There was a single narrow old maid's bed. She opened the closet door and reached behind her hanging clothes. She was on her knees now, sweating. She drew out a brightly colored box with a photograph of laughing adults on the front, adults who were playing a party game that was at least 3,000 years old. She had found the planchette in a downtown novelty shop, but she dared not use it in the house, not with the boy here. In fact, she had not dared use it at all, until now. Something had impelled her into the shop, and when she had seen the planchette in its gay party box, a terrible struggle had gone on inside her, the sort of struggle psychologists call aversion compulsion. She had wanted to hurry out of that shop without looking back, but she had also wanted to snatch the box, that dreadful gay box, and carry it home with her. But she shouldn't. After what had happened that time in college, she shouldn't. But at last, she had taken the box. That had been 4 days ago. Each night, the compulsion had grown stronger until tonight, half insane with fears she didn't understand. She had gone to Larry wearing the blue-gray dress with nothing on underneath. She had gone to put an end to the fears for good. Waiting on the porch for them to get back from the meeting, she had been sure she had finally done the right thing. There had been that feeling in her, that lightly drunk, star-struck feeling, that she'd not properly had since she had run across the dew-drenched grass with the boy behind her. Only this time the boy would catch her. She would let him catch her. It would be the end. But when he had caught her, he hadn't wanted her. Nadine stood up, holding the box to her chest, and put out the lamp. He had scorned her. And didn't they say that hell hath no fury? A scorned woman might well traffic with the devil, or his henchmen. She paused only long enough to get the large flashlight from the table in the front hall. From deeper inside the house, the boy cried out in his sleep, freezing her for a moment, making the hair prickle on her scalp. Then she let herself out. Her Vespa was at the curb, the Vespa she had used some days ago to motor up to Harold Lauder's house. Why had she gone there? Her Vespa was at the curb, the Vespa she had used some days ago to motor up to Harold Lauder's house. Why had she gone there? She hadn't passed a dozen words with Harold since she'd gotten to Boulder. But in her confusion about the planchette, and in her terror of the dreams that continued to come to her even after everyone else's had stopped, it had seemed to her that she must talk about it to Harold. She had been afraid of that impulse, too. It seemed to be an idea that had come to her from outside herself. His thought, maybe. But when she had given in and gone to Harold's, he hadn't been at home. The house was locked, the only locked house she had come upon in Boulder, and the shades were drawn. She had rather liked that, and she'd had a moment's bitter disappointment that Harold was not there. If he had been, he could have let her in and then locked the door behind her. They could have gone into the living room and talked, or made love, or have done unspeakable things together, and no one would have known. Harold's was a private place. "What's happening to me?" she whispered to the dark, but the dark had no answer for her. She started the Vespa, and the steady burping pop of its engine seemed to profane the night. She put it in gear and drove away, to the west. Moving, the cool night air on her face, she felt better at last. "Blow away the cobwebs, night wind. You know, don't you? When all the choices but one have been taken away, what do you do?" You choose what's left. You choose whatever dark adventure was meant for you. You let Larry have his stupid little twist of tail with her tight pants and her single-syllable vocabulary and her movie magazine mind. You go beyond them. You risk whatever there is to be risked. The road unrolled before her in the baby spotlight of the Vespa's headlamp. She had to switch to second gear as the road began to climb. She was on Baseline Road now, heading up the Black Mountain. Let them have their meetings. They were concerned with getting the power back on. Her lover was concerned with the world. The Vespa's engine lugged and strained and somehow carried on. A horrible yet sexy kind of fear began to grip her, and the vibrating saddle of the motorbike began to heat her up down there. "Why, you're horny, Nadine," she thought with shrill good humor. "Naughty, naughty, naughty!" To her right was a straight drop-off. Nothing but death down there. And up above? Well, she would see. It was too late to turn back, and that thought alone made her feel paradoxically and deliciously free. An hour later, she was in Sunrise Amphitheater, but Sunrise was still 3 or more hours away. The amphitheater was close to the summit of Flagstaff Mountain, and nearly everyone in the free zone had made the trip to the camping area at the top before they had been in Boulder very long. On a clear day, which was most days in Boulder, at least during the summer season, you could see Boulder and I-25 stretching away south to Denver, and then off into the haze toward New Mexico, 200 miles beyond. Due east were the flatlands, stretching away toward Nebraska, and closer at hand was Boulder Canyon, a knife gash through foothills that were walled in pine and spruce. In summers gone by, gliders had plied the thermals over Sunrise Amphitheater like birds. Now Nadine saw only what was revealed in the glow of the 6-cell flashlight which she put on a picnic table near the drop-off. There was a large artist's sketch pad turned back to a clean sheet, and squatting on it the 3-cornered planchette like a triangular spider. Protruding from its belly like a spider's stinger was a pencil, lightly touching the pad. Nadine was in a feverish state that was half euphoria, half terror. Coming up here on the back of her gamely laboring Vespa, which had most decidedly not been made for mountain climbing, she had felt what Harold had felt in Nederland. She could feel him. But while Harold had felt it as a sort of magnetism, a drawing toward, Nadine felt it as a kind of mystic event, a border crossing. It was as if these mountains, of which he was even now only in the foothills, were a no-man's land between 2 spheres of influence. Flag in the west, the old woman in the east. And here the magic flew both ways, mixing, making its own concoction that belonged neither to God nor to Satan, but which was totally pagan. She felt she was in a haunted place. And the planchette. She had tossed the brightly marked box, stamped Made in Taiwan, away indifferently for the wind to take. The planchette itself was only a poorly stamped piece of fiberboard or gypsum, but it didn't matter. It was a tool she would use only once, only dared to use once. And even a poorly made tool can serve its purpose. To break open a door, to close a window, to write a name. The words on the box recurred. Amaze your friends. Brighten up your get-togethers. What was that song Larry sometimes bellowed from the seat of his Honda as they rode along? Hello, Central. What's the matter with your line? I want to talk to... Talk to who? But that was the question, wasn't it? Her heart beating loudly, Nadine sat down on the picnic bench and pressed her fingers lightly to 2 of the planchette's 3 sides. She could feel it begin to move under the balls of her fingers almost immediately, and she thought of a car with its engine idling. But who was the driver? Who was he really? Who would climb in and slam the door and put his sun-blackened hands on the wheel? Whose foot, brutal and heavy, shod in an old and dusty cowboy boot, would come down on the accelerator and take her? Where? Driver, where are you taking us? Nadine, beyond help or hope of succor, sat upright on the bench at the crest of Flagstaff Mountain in the black trench of morning, her eyes wide, that feeling of being on the border stronger than ever. She felt his dark presence coming in waves. Somewhere, flag was abroad in the night, and she spoke 2 words like an incantation to all the black spirits that had ever been. Incantation and invitation. Tell me. And beneath her fingers, the planchette began to write.